let me start with an introduction. My name is Sarah Milligan, and I'm with the Kentucky Historical Society, and I'm here interviewing Mr. Monroe Monday, and I love your name. Today's date is November 12th, 2010, and we will be talking a little bit about Mr. Monday's experience in the U.S. Air Force during World War II. So, first off, let's just talk a little bit about where you're from, about yourself, who are your parents, and where were you born, where are you from, those sorts of things.
Okay, I'm originally from Knoxville, Tennessee. My parents, Dad was a long-time resident of the Knoxville area in the country, and then came into town, and Mother came to Knoxville in the late 1800s and settled there, and Grandfather published a Union type of a newspaper, so he was well known, and so the Mondays were real well known. So I came out of a area that the name of Monday and Ford meant a whole lot to at least walking around and saying, "I'm Monroe Monday." "Oh yeah, I know your dad. I know your uncle. I know your cousin," and all of those things. Dad was in the post office, and he had met Mother in the post office, and they married, and she, of course, quit working, and had four children, four boys. I won't display my ignorance and try to say what their ages are. I'm the only one left living.
Were you the youngest?
No, I'm next to the youngest. And all of them lived up until just recently. So, I mean, they're all long lives. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm the second, I'm running second in life terms. You got to go way back to catch the ages of others. I'm 85, and I've outlived many of my relatives and my dad and my uncles. So I guess it's because I was busy at the YMCA.
It may have had something to do with it.
Yeah. As I say, we lived in Knoxville. Dad had a month's vacation, and a lady up the street from us had a cabin up in the mountains at a place called Elkmont. Now, Elkmont is a campground now, but at the time it was a point in which the loggers brought the logs to Elkmont, and they loaded them onto a, not the big trains, the small trains, the what are they? The two rails or something, and
not a freight train, but a cargo train.
Well, they were just, you know, opened up, and they just loaded the logs.
Oh, right.
Onto the trains.
Yeah,
and they hauled them down the mountain to Tremont, and there was a, they had set up, the lumber people had set up a lumber mill there. And so they cut the trees up and then shipped them on to other points.
Did you work much with that?
No.
No.
No. Actually, that was an earlier happening. And what happened is that the people of Knoxville would ride the train up to Elkmont and get off and pitch tents and spend a week or 2 weeks or whatever length of time they wanted to. Mm-hmm. And then they started buying property from the lumber mills, because mm-hmm. the lumbers owned all that land. And so they took it over, and people went up there and built little sheds, as well as some areas they got real ambitious and built some beautiful homes. Mm-hmm. Eventually, the national park came in and took over everything, and the people that had cabins up there mm-hmm. Had right to retain the use of it through one generation mm-hmm. or one set of the oldest children mm-hmm. of the family that had built it. So we had a neighbor that had this cabin up there, and it was a rough cabin. I mean, it was real rough, but we enjoyed going up there. And I guess from the time I was 8 years old, we would go up there for the month of August. And there was a boys' camp uh-huh. there also. And we would go over to their lake that yeah. was a swimming pool, and would swim. And of course, when all the campers came, we left. I mean, they had Boku campers mm-hmm. that came in, so they took over everything.
So this was in the Smoky Mountains, is
this
that right?
This was in the Smoky Mountains. Elkmont is still there uh-huh. as a campground that's managed by the
National Park Service,
by the Park Association.
Yeah. Well, so you spent a lot of time in the woods as a child.
Yes.
Let's kind of move towards where did you go to high school?
Knoxville High School.
You're still in Knoxville?
Yes.
Uh-huh. What year did you graduate? Do you remember?
1943.
When did you enter the Air Force?
1943.
Right when you got out.
I graduated from high school in June of 43 and entered into the Army in 44. I mean into July of 43.
So right after you graduated.
Right after I graduated, I went in.
What made you decide to do that?
Uncle Sam says, "We want you." Mm-hmm. And I was drafted.
You were drafted.
Yes. Yeah, everybody, as they were graduating from high school, was drafted. A few of them went in and enlisted to make their own selection of the branch of service that they wanted. But I just waited for them to call me up and say, come on. And
it's pretty quick.
Yeah. Graduated in June and went into service in July.
Do you remember how you felt about that?
I was looking forward to it. I mean, all of the kids had been doing that from the previous year. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I was looking forward to it. I was expecting it. It wasn't anything that I was not expecting. And I had, by my association with the YMCA, I had been mixed with a lot of people, and we did lots of things. We did some out-of-town trips, and so I wasn't one that was alone. When I went into the Army, I mean, I was just with a mixture of people that I didn't necessarily know, and it was surprising. You would have thought that out of several hundred that had graduated from high school, that so few of us were in the same groupings. In fact, I really don't remember anybody that I knew that was in my group there for basic training.
Really?
And of course, oh gosh, they had people from Alabama, Louisiana, Kentucky, and I can't remember where else.
Where did you go to basic training?
We went to Keesler Field, Mississippi, Biloxi.
Yeah.
And that was summertime.
Oh.
That was August.
Oh.
Oh, I tell you, it was hot. And they loaded us onto a train at Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia, which is just outside of Chattanooga. And
actually, can you see me?
Yeah.
We'll turn that off.
Fort Oglethorpe was just outside of Chattanooga. And so they loaded us onto a train, and they wouldn't tell us where we were going. And it was nighttime, late afternoon, so here we were in a Pullman. I mean, not in a Pullman, but in a, you know, seats.
Yeah, and like passenger train.
Passenger train. So just about everybody in there managed to unscrew the screws in the back of the seat and let it fall back, and then everybody could lie down. So
that's pretty clever.
So we said, well, y'all didn't give us a Pullman, we made ourselves a Pullman. And the old the conductor, he came through there when we were about halfway through doing it and says, y'all shouldn't be doing that, says it's going to cost the government to get those things fixed. And we said, well, you should have sent us a Pullman. He says, well, you talk to the Army about that. But we were kind of disgusted that here we were headed off somewhere. We didn't know where. They didn't tell us where. And later on, we were able to find out that we were going to Biloxi. And we got there like, oh gosh, I don't know, it was not daylight. And we unloaded from the cars, and they had trucks there and piled us into trucks. And we had two barracks bags. You know what I mean? Barracks bags.
Describe one for me.
They were just great big, canvas, heavy. They weren't canvas.
Like duffel bags?
Duffel bags.
Yeah.
And all of our clothing, everything we had been issued was there. And it was heavy. I mean, it was heavy. It had summer and winter and everything. So we had to lug those things. And they finally put us on trucks and took us onto the air base and dumped us out and says, go down in this little row of barracks here, any barracks that you want to, get in there and find your bed and go to sleep. We had gone to supply area, and they had given us pillows, mattresses, blankets, sheets, and everything. And that, in addition to our two barracks bags.
Yeah.
And we had to lug all of that to barracks. And the next morning, I vaguely remember hearing people saying, come on and get up and fall in out here and let's go to breakfast. Well, I rolled over, and I think everybody else in the barracks rolled over. They came back two or three more times, and after the third time, I finally said, well, I guess maybe if I don't get up now, I won't get any breakfast. So I got up and fell in, and they took us to breakfast and came back to the barracks and lined us up and put us into line and started the process of inducting us into the Army.
Yeah.
They did not have a full physical exam. They had a minor one. And guess that checked us out enough to know that we were okay. And they took us then to a barracks.
Mm-hmm.
And they said this was our barracks, and to stay there, to grab a bed and make it up, and to stay there. And later on, they came in and got us again and marched us. And I'll be honest, I can't remember where.
That's okay.
I mean,
That
was 1943, and what year it is?
Yeah, 2010.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to. I mean, I think it's, I was just sitting here thinking how interesting it is that you remember even that they had to call you three times before you got up for breakfast.
Yeah. After that, they took us, I don't know.
Well, so you went through basic training, and that lasted, do you remember how long you were there? Like a few months, or?
Several months. We were there from July until fall.
So September, October, probably.
Yeah, November also.
November.
Yeah.
So do you remember?
We got to Denver. That's where we went to on Thanksgiving.
From Mississippi to Denver.
Yeah.
Wow.
We went from Mississippi, which was basic training, which was marching and drilling and learning to shoot guns and a whole lot of indoctrination into what's expected of us in the Army.
Yeah.
We were actually in the Air Force.
The Army Air Force?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We had a choice at Keesler Field to go into a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them, my older brother had just come back from Africa. He had been involved in the African campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, Ed, I'm halfway interested in going into the tank corps. Says, what do you think about that? And he says, you don't want to go into the tank corps. He says, all across Africa, there are burned out tanks, just the carcasses of them left there, their American tanks and their German tanks, and says, you don't want to get in the tank corps. So that said goodbye. And when I got then to the point of making a selection, I said to them, I would kind of like to maybe get into the Signal Corps. That sounded like it would be real interesting. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, soldier says, you select the Army, Navy, or Air Force at this point, says, and then you go to the Army or the Navy, and they then divide you up there. We don't divide you up. And says, right now, and see, this was in 1943, mm-hmm. in June, and the big push, the invasion was in the following year. Mm-hmm. So I knew that was going to happen. So I said, I'll take the Air Force. I says, if I get back from a mission, says, at least I've got a bed to sleep in, and I got a hot meal to eat. Mm-hmm. And I'll have a better setup than sitting in a German prisoner camp or walking across Germany.
Yeah.
I always envisioned that if we got shot down, that we'd bail out and we'd be able to walk out of Germany. Well, you couldn't walk very far. Mm-hmm. And that was a teenager's hope that he could walk out of Germany.
Yeah. So you went to Denver when you chose the Air Force, it sounds like.
After basic training, we went to Denver to armament school. Mm-hmm. And we learned how to shoot the machine guns. We shot submachine guns, pistols, rifles. I guess that's all.
Yeah.
And we had all sorts of training of, if people got hurt.
Like first aid.
First aid type training. Yeah. And what to do if you get lost. If you get shot down and you're lost out in the woods, you mm-hmm. were told you weren't supposed to wander around in daylight. You were supposed to find a place that was hidden and wait and get out at nighttime and try to walk. And we were told that we had maps of the area that we carried with us, and a little compass, and that mm-hmm. we could, you know, find out where we were from where our mission was, mm-hmm. and that we could then strike out walking. I didn't really run into one or two people that bailed out who were not picked up by the Germans within a few days.
Yeah.
Nobody had any extended period of time that they were out wandering around in Germany.
So your survival training was maybe making you think that you could walk out and save yourself, but what you were hearing from people was that that wasn't the reality.
It wasn't doubted. Well, remember, at that given time, and this would have been early 1944, we had just invaded France. The Germans still occupied the biggest part of France when we were flying. Mm-hmm. So They owned all of France, all of Holland, and everything along the Belgium coast.
Yeah.
And so you didn't really have any place to go.
So when did you find out where you were being sent?
Well, we went to Denver, and after we went through armament school, which I think took about 6 weeks.
Okay.
The next step was to a gunnery school where we learned to shoot the guns. And this included shooting from a flying airplane. So we started flying and shooting at ground targets and air targets. And I'll tell you, you shot everything. We had BB guns, automatic BB guns. And we would go into this area, and they had these little model airplanes on tracks, and we had machine guns of BBs, and our job was to shoot them, and we could actually knock them off of their track
with your BB guns.
Yeah, with our BB guns, and that was fun. It was interesting, and it was good training. I mean, they would come up from different angles and so forth.
Yeah.
Another one in the training, gunnery training, is we went into it's like the great big domed theaters that I haven't been to a theater in so long that I can't remember. But anyhow, it was a big dome theater, and they shot airplanes by cameras.
Oh.
They had cameras of them, and they would come out from every angle. And we had a machine gun that we would shoot. And if we hit it, it rang a bell, and it registered on our machine gun that we hit the airplane.
Were you shooting real bullets?
No, it was just lights.
Just lights.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so we enjoyed that very much, and we did an awful lot of that type of training, because, I mean, that was good. I mean, you had airplanes coming in from all different angles, and you had more than one that would be coming in towards you, and you were responsible for tracking these airplanes and being able to follow them and to keep up with them.
So were they training you for a specific job at that point?
Yes, I was. Okay, I'm sorry. I went to Denver, and I went to gunnery school.
So you were going to be a gunner.
I was going to be a gunner. And they trained me as a waist gunner, which meant I was on the side of the B-17, standing with a gun that was hooked up. Also, I was trained on the ball turret that was underneath the airplane. Ooh, I didn't like that.
So you'd have to be the one under. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, you get down into the turret, and after you get in and you hook your belts and everything on, you reach up and pull the back up and hook it, and then you take a hold of your guns, which were your controls, and you would push them this way.
Push them forward.
And the turret then would go backwards.
Oh my gosh.
And there you would be hanging out
there. Oh, it doesn't sound like any fun.
It was. That was scary. And I'm glad they did not put me as a permanent ball turret gunner. I just did not like it. It was scary. And you were on your back, and you go around, you know.
From side to side, swing side to side, yeah.
And you could go up and down, you know, all around.
Yeah.
So after you'd been in it for a while, and I mean for weeks, you got used to it. And I could have gotten used to. I would have gotten over the fear. They told us we would be afraid, that we would get over it, either in basic training or whenever we got assigned to a crew,
yeah.
That we would be used to flying that way. But from that, from at gunnery school, we flew just all the time. I mean, every day we'd get in the airplane. And part of the flying was actually the training for the bombardier, the navigator, and the pilot. The pilot had to go to a certain point. The navigator had to lead him to that point. The bombardier would have specific targets that he was supposed to bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it came for him to do any bombing, it was my job to go into the middle of the airplane, just back of the radio room, which was back of the Bombay. And I opened up a great big door and got down in there, and then I opened up two other doors.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a great big camera there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was one of those great old big cameras.
Like, and 3 feet big camera?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would have to listen to the bombardier, and he'd tell me, you know, I'm going to the right, I'm going to the left, and I could, you know, follow his directions. And then he'd say, bombs away. And when he'd say, bombs away, I would push a button, and it would make a picture.
Really?
Made pictures of him dropping the bombs. And so, I mean, after the bombs had hit, then would start all over again. And we did a lot of bombing that way. And what amazed me, they won't bother me now, I'm out of the service, was that I was amazed that we as gunners didn't get as much practice of somebody coming at us and us shooting. We shot at ground targets, and we shot at airplanes that were towing targets and things like that, but we didn't do a tremendous amount of what I call training. But I guess I had enough training that when I went overseas, we were never attacked, I thank goodness.
Yeah.
I felt confident that I could pick up an airplane out there and, you know, follow it and shoot my gun at it.
Yeah.
And take care of it that way.
So when they did send you, where did they send you?
After we finished gunnery school, we went to crew assignments. this was just everybody mm-hmm. at Gunnery School. And they called us all out one day and had us all lined up and called groups of names out. And okay, and actually we were boarding a train. You all board train number one, and you're going in Casey 11, and would go in there.
Yeah.
And we didn't even know at that time who our crewmates were.
Yeah.
They called the names out, but it's just like standing up there and calling a roll, and you couldn't keep up with whose name was where and what, and so on. So it didn't really matter. And they told us that it didn't matter that they told us what barracks we were to go to,
mm-hmm.
and that we would then find out our crew assignments there.
Mm-hmm.
That was at Gulfport.
So you were assigned to a crew.
We were assigned to a crew, and we went for flight training. And you know, I meant to get my book out and do this and read it. And I didn't know where it was.
It's okay. A lot of the pieces of the details of where you kind of went the places, you know, you can look up research and know what Gulfport did. You know, you can, there are things like that. So it's more just what you remember about the experiences you had, more than the exact details of things.
Yeah. Well, so we went into someplace in Texas for a flight training, and we were assigned to our entire crew, and we did ground shooting
mm-hmm.
as well as air shooting,
mm-hmm.
and that was...
Sounds like February or March, probably.
Yeah. It seems to me like we got out of that in March.
March.
Yeah. We'd been to Denver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you went to Denver, yeah.
Yeah.
And you did a lot of your initial, I think it sounds like you did a lot of your initial gunnery training there.
Yeah.
And then your crew that you were assigned to was sent to Texas.
Yes.
And then after you did some more gunnery training, it sounds like, team training in Texas. Where did you head from there?
From that, we went to overseas training base, which was at Gulfport, Mississippi.
Okay, so they sent you to Mississippi after Texas.
Yeah.
And that was, what overseas training, what did they teach you there?
Well, we were actually assigned to a crew, and we were not our own particular squadron,
mm-hmm.
but we went up and formed a squadron of airplanes, and we would go out and we would shoot at our airplanes as they would come in towards us, attacking us, and mm-hmm. we had cameras. The guns had cameras on them.
Okay.
And they would look at the cameras. We never saw the results of our shooting, but they told us that they looked at all of the cameras, and that if you weren't getting your shots in, you were into trouble.
Hmm.
That they would separate you out from the group and put you into a group over here that weren't so hot.
Did that happen to anyone you know?
I don't remember.
No.
I don't remember anybody that I knew that got demoted.
So they, it sounds like they trained you a lot by filming where your target, you know, where you were supposed to be targeting.
Yes.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And these were live airplanes. I mean, they had regular pilots in it. And they were coming in at all their different angles. And they were, two of them would come in at the same time, or one here and one there. So it was real good training. They gave us as good of training as I think they could have given us to be a gunner on a B-17. I mean, I felt comfortable the whole time that I was flying, that if the German fighters made an attack on us, that I was capable of picking an airplane out and shooting at it and picking the right airplanes out. Oh, I never will forget. We were flying along, and of course, as we were flying, they had it recorded, and we were to try to spot the airplanes. Well, I looked way out there, and I could see this whole mass of airplanes. And I said, I called my crewmates, and I says, fellas, at 4:30, which was, you know, 4:30 time in the o'clock, at 4:30, in the very farthest distance, there are a batch of fighters out there, and they are headed in our direction. They're not real fast, but they are not, but they're fighters. And I says, you better look out. So somebody on the crew looked, and everybody was looking and talking. So finally one of the fellows says, well, Monday, that was good looking. Says, you spotted something way out. But says, that's another formation of B-17s or B-24s, and they're making a turn, and they're headed in a similar direction that we're going in. And I said, well, it's a good thing I didn't shoot any. I mean, you're standing there, and I mean, you're just standing there and looking, and there's nothing out there, and you're just, for hours, you're standing there just looking out in the sky. And then all of a sudden, you see these little black dots way off, and they look like airplanes, and they are airplanes. But they were bombers.
Yeah.
And if they'd gotten closer, I could have recognized them as bombers. But all I was seeing was the engines.
Yeah. Well, that takes some patience to be able to do, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you got so tired. And in the waist, you stood up. And I don't know if you've been in any of the bombers that would have been out here at the airport. Well, the next time that they have a display of B-17s out at the airport, and they do them periodically, and it gets in the newspaper and on the radio, you ought to go out there and go through a B-17 bomber and just see what it's like. I mean, they were a big airplane.
Yeah.
But when you look at it now and you think of commercial passenger planes and military airplanes that you see in TV and so forth, I mean, it's just a little airplane, but it was a huge airplane. When I walked into a hangar down at, I guess at Keesler Field, and there was a B-17 sitting in there, and I just couldn't imagine that I was going to get on that huge airplane and was going to fly in that thing. And even when I got in it, I mean, it was a huge airplane. And it was. I mean, a B-17 was a big airplane.
Yeah.
I don't remember any of the dimensions of it.
Well, that's easy, to figure out. Well, so what happened after Gulfport in Mississippi, after that training there? Where'd you go?
Okay, after we finished all of our training there, and we did a lot of night training, too, where we would fly. We'd fly from Gulfport to Knoxville.
Yeah.
And the bombardier would bomb a bridge in Knoxville.
Oh.
And Knoxville was my hometown. Yeah. And so I can remember that they went in and they bombed the Henley Street Bridge, which was the main bridge that connected North Knoxville and South Knoxville going across the Tennessee River. And there wasn't another bridge around.
Did they really bomb it?
No.
Just fake?
They just, made a camera shot of it. But, I mean, it was, you didn't go to a town and just play like you were bombing. You went to a town and you actually had a camera that showed your bomb, and they read those things.
Yeah.
And if a bombardier kept on missing his targets, they really got after him. And
so it sounds like you were training more as a bombardier than you were a gunner at this point.
Yeah, I really did. I did not feel that I had enough training as a gunner. I did not think that they gave us enough training flying and shooting. And but then when I got thinking about it, the movies that we shot at and everything, we got the reality there, and that really the reality would be when the German airplanes would come in and attack us, that we would have to know how to lead them and when to shoot. I know when I got through at gunnery school, I says, I don't think we've had enough training. But then after I got overseas, I says, well, I guess we did.
Well, let's talk about that when you were sent overseas.
Okay. This would have been in early fall.
1944, yeah.
Yeah. October, I believe it was. We went someplace. I don't remember.
Yeah.
We had already had our crew assignments.
To what crew or division were you assigned to?
Just a crew.
Okay.
We did not get a division or anything assignment until we got to England.
So you were sent to England?
Yeah, we went from Savannah. We flew out of Savannah and flew to England. We flew up to to Washington and spent the night at Washington. And then the next night we went up into New England someplace, and I don't remember.
Yeah, it didn't matter.
And then the next night,
So anyway, you landed in England. It was your first place in Europe.
Yes, and we landed there, and it was a brand new airplane, and it was loaded with all sorts of stuff. The Bombay was loaded with all sorts of stuff, and so we left the airplane there, mm-hmm. and they unloaded it and sent the stuff to wherever it was supposed to go. And we then were put in trucks and went to, I went to there in England when I was back in England a couple, 3 years ago, and now the name of it slips me.
Did you go in through Liverpool?
No.
No?
No. No, Liverpool. We came in to the upper part.
Okay.
We came in to Wales.
Okay.
Yeah, we came into Wales. And Liverpool
yeah.
is way down here on English, English Channel.
Channel. Mm-hmm.
And we were up there in where it was real cold. And we spent a day or two there. And then we were put in trucks and were distributed to another base. And we spent 3 or 4 days there. And then they loaded us in trucks again. And they sent us then to our actual air base.
Okay.
And the air base they sent us to, we had a major as a pilot. This major had been an instructor in Texas. Mm-hmm. He had been instructing on small aircrafts and in big aircrafts, B-17s.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided that he was tired of being an instructor and he wanted to go overseas. So they pulled his name out and our names, our crew, drew Major Corgis.
Corgis with a C? Or
a K.
K, court, K-O-R-G-I-S.
K-O-R-G-E-S.
G-E-S.
Major Corgis.
So you all were suited with Major Corgis, and do you remember where you were stationed?
Well, we were stationed, and I can't call the name of it.
Was it still in England?
Yes, it's okay. All in England.
Okay.
There were three bases. There was one here and one here and one here.
So north, central, and southern kind of areas. North England, kind of central England and southern
yeah,
England.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But I'm saying our three bomb groups.
Oh, okay.
There were three bomb groups.
I see.
Right here, and we were in this one, and this one, and then there was this one,
okay.
All in one wing.
Oh, I see. So and, you were all just kind of next to each other.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And that messed up the plan of rotation of and promotion of a man that they were ready to promote to be a major.
Oh.
So they got on their telephone and got permission to see if they couldn't get our crew reassigned somewhere else. And I don't know what they had to do, how many places, but they got a group there. A bomb group mm-hmm. is 36 airplanes.
Okay.
So the bomb group that we ended up in was just adjacent to it.
Okay.
And we were in the 351st. I don't have my shirt on.
351st?
Bomb group.
Okay. Was that within another...
That was within the 8th Air Force.
Air Force Division. Okay. Okay, so you have, now you have your team set up. You have your major, you have your bomb group that you're in. What happened then?
Well, we flew two or three practice missions, mm-hmm. which was really nothing but for the pilot to get used to flying the airplanes there mm-hmm. That had been used. And the navigator of, you know, navigating along the coast. Mm-hmm. And the bombardier, he dropped some bombs. Mm-hmm. And when I say he dropped a bomb, he didn't actually drop one. He just would say to me, "Bombs away." Okay. And he would have, out of his bomb sight, he would have it targeted the building he was going to bomb, mm-hmm. and it would make a picture okay. of it. So when I say that part of these things, I took bombs away, that it wasn't actually dropping the bombs.
You didn't destroy anything, it was just an exercise.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And so we did several of those type of flights. And then one morning, about 3 o'clock in the morning, 2:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, they came into the barracks and called out names of everybody. And here came our names. I mean, it was by crews.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my name was not at the beginning. Actually, for some reason, my name was the last name of our crew that was called to fly. And so at that point, they said that breakfast was, and I don't remember, we'll say 5 o'clock. It was earlier than that. It was like 3:30, maybe 3 o'clock. And that briefing then was at 4 o'clock. And that takeoff was at 7 o'clock. And so, I mean, they called out the time elements that we were supposed to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that after breakfast, we would walk to where our flight equipment was.
Mm-hmm.
Had a great big room that had areas that here was all of my flying equipment. And I would change clothes there and hang my clothes up in the box and get the bag that we had electric flying suits. They were like electric blankets.
Oh.
I don't know whether you had ever heard that, of the electric flying suits. And we, of course, wore long underwear. And we pulled on our electric flying suit. And then we had a heavy flying suit that was, I can't remember what they called it. It wasn't the old type that you had seen as wool. This was a new fabric. It was kind of a, I don't know what it was, mm-hmm. but it was warm. And we put those things on. And we had boots that were warm that way, and we had electric shoes in those boots.
Well, how did the electric, were they on a battery system?
No, when we got into the airplane, at my waist gun, there was a spot there that I would plug in the electric connection from my flying suit to this. And of course, the airplane itself would generate electricity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had four great big huge engines. So, I mean, it made enough electricity to run all of the electrical instruments, the radio, and keep everybody warm.
Yeah.
So we'd get onto the plane and plug in our flight. Well, we didn't actually plug it in then.
Mm.
We'd get in the plane, and we'd all gather into the radio room. It was warm to begin with, and it was cold in England.
Yeah.
And we would stay in that even after takeoff, and because we could actually doze in there until we would reach 10,000 feet in altitude, which did not take too long. And all the time we were going up, 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 up. Because while we were going up, if our plane was the lead plane in the squadron,
mm-hmm.
it went first.
Okay.
The associate lead was to the right, and the left side was another plane, and then back here was another one.
Back behind the first one.
Yeah. So that's four airplanes, and you made three flights of those. So one flight was here, one was here, and one was over here.
Mm-hmm.
There was never an American plane under you. And it took four groups to make a bomb group.
Mm-hmm.
Not a bomb group, a squadron.
Okay.
So you had 12 airplanes in a squadron, and you had three squadrons, which was 36 in a bomb group.
Yeah.
And they were all stacked in this same manner, mm-hmm. which gave us complete coverage of everything on the outside, down, as well as up. There wasn't any chance of us shooting any of our own airplanes down. And so we would go up, and we would stay in the radio room until basically the pilot got us into formation and everybody was in a group. And by that time, we were at 15,000 feet and we needed oxygen. And we went to our positions and hooked up our electric suits and our oxygen. And we were actually in formation, and we were in our formation in the groups. I mean, we could look back of us and see, you know, a group of airplanes back of us, and could look in front and see, because they were all strung out that way. And so we did that. As I vaguely recall, I flew my first mission early in November of 1940, 1943. The invasion was in June of 43.
And that's when you went into basic. So yeah. You went to England in 1944.
So I went to England in 44, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I flew my first mission then in November of 44. Yeah, that's right.
So that was the one that they woke you up at 2 in the morning for?
Yeah.
Where did you all go? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah, we went. Oh, you mean that mission?
Yeah.
We went to Dole, D-O-L-E.
Mm-hmm.
Dole was on the German coast. It was a combination small seaport, and they had a lot of railroads that came into there.
Okay.
And we bombed the railroad yards. And
successfully returned, sounds like.
Yeah. We had, the Germans fired what they call flak at us, F-L-A-K. I guess how you would spell it. That was 155-meter cannons, and they were great big shells, and they would explode and throw all these huge pieces of steel out of the shell, mm-hmm. and out of the inside of the shell. They loaded them with powder and then shells, because the shells exploded at a certain altitude when he shot it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would, you know, get up there and then explode around all the airplanes that mm-hmm. were there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just black. I mean, all this black smoke of all the shells.
Mm-hmm.
Some days they could really put it up. Other days they didn't. They had some rookies down there trying to fire their guns. They didn't do a good job of it.
Did they ever get close to hitting you while you were up there?
Oh, yeah, we got hit numerous times.
Yeah.
It was not unusual because you had all of these shells. And, I mean, you were just flying through smoke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could smell the smoke as you would go through it, or you'd be around it. We got hit several times. We could hear the shells exploding and the fragments flying through the air and hitting our plane. And when they would hit us, the fragments would come in this side of the airplane and would go all the way through and hit the other side and go out.
Well, that sounds dangerous.
Yeah, oh yeah, it was. It was. Yeah, a lot of people lost their lives from being hit by flak.
Yeah.
One time, their flak just hit in our tail area, and when we got down to low altitude, I went back there, and I could find the hole in the airplane, and I looked all over the area back there, and I forgot what it was that was stored back there. There was something stored. that we would use. And as I was ready to give up on finding the piece of flak, I just happened to see this piece of metal about yay big, that
about 2 inches
had, you know, hit that stuff and had fallen, you know, there. And so I picked it up and I have it at home.
Well, you kept it.
Yeah. I meant to, while it was warm weather, to, I have everything that I had in the Army, or the biggest part of it, in footlockers, which are green locker boxes, stored out there, my ribbons, my medals, and everything. And I meant this summer to go out there and to dig those boxes out from under the stacks of everything I have in the garage, and and go through them and get things out and give them to my girls. I have two girls. They're 52 and 54, 53 and 55, something like that. They both have birthdays coming up. They're going to be old people.
Not by today's standards. So that was your first mission. How many missions do you think that you went on while you were over there?
35. Yeah.
Oh.
We would fly one day. We wouldn't fly then the next, and we would fly whenever they told us to. Flighting depended upon the weather in Europe, whether or not there was real heavy cloud cover. If the cloud cover was too heavy, our radar wouldn't go through the clouds good enough to give them real good coverage on it. And then bad weather. I mean, when they had a lot of rain and wind and snow and everything, we couldn't fly.
Right. So you got there in October 1944. How long did you stay in the European theater in England?
I finished flying my last mission on my birthday.
Lucky for you.
Yeah, which was March the 4th, 1945.
So between November and March, you flew 35 missions. That sounds like a lot to me.
It was. We lost several weeks of flying. There was one mission that we went on that... literally, we got shot down. We got shot down and made it back to Brussels, to an emergency landing field. And they told us to try to land there if our wheels would come down. And if our wheels wouldn't come down, they'd told us another place to go, that there were no trees and we would go in without wheels and just land, you know.
Crash land.
But we didn't know where our wheels came down or not. We tried cranking and the cables had been broken, shot out, and the electrical cables had been shot out. Mm-hmm. So we cranked and turned the electricity on. So we didn't know whether we were going to be able to land or not. And as we got closer to the airfield, we called the airbase and says, we don't know whether we have wheels or not. Says, you tell us whether we got wheels that we can land on or not. And they said, oh, you can't land. This was an English airbase. And they had women as the monitors on the radio. And they were hard to understand. The English men were hard to understand. The women were harder. And so she kept saying, sir, I'm sorry, you can't land now. Says, I have a damaged the English flight fighter that's in front of you, and he's going to have to land, and he can't go around. Says he shot up too much. And my pilot, which was no longer the major, he only flew 7 missions with us, and they moved him into headquarters, and he became a lead pilot and had rank. So our pilot says, well, I'll tell you what, lady. Says, I'm not going to turn this airplane one way or the other. I have glided this far on one engine. And says, I have glided downhill all the way to here. Says, you tell that English airplane he'd better get out of our way, because we're going to land as right as soon as we can. And we hit that runway, and the pilot kept saying, tell him to move on, tell him to move on. And he finally got out of our way. He had enough speed, was far enough in front of us that he was able to go on and get out of our way. But his airplane and our airplane were still there a month, 6 weeks later, when both of us, or when we were shot down again and had to land there. We ran out of gas, and we had to land there rather than trying to go back to England. We wouldn't have had enough gas to go on back to England. We were fairly close to the English coast, but the pilot said there was not enough gas in the plane to carry us across the English Channel. Mm-hmm. So he said, we're going in. I says, can't we go to Paris? I says, we've been to Brussels a few weeks ago. Says, and I've got some money now. We always were told, and we always did it. We take all of our money and our wallet and anything of any value and check it in, mm-hmm. so that if we were shot down or were forced out, that they could forward our stuff to our parents. Mm-hmm. And I says, we got paid not too long ago, and I got plenty of money. Let's go to Paris. And the pilot said, no, I can't do that. Says, I'm not sure if we got enough gas to get to Paris. And if we do, says they told us to land at the nearest air base, and they'll get on to me if I don't. So,
so how did you all get back from Brussels? How long did you have to stay there?
Well, that first time, that was when we got shot up. We got shot all to pieces on that mission. We had 3 engines shot out.
Oh.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're fortunate to have made it to Brussels then.
Yeah, we were. We were. I was standing there watching for airplanes, and boom! I mean, this great big blast to hit our airplane, and picked us up, threw us up in the air like this, way up like this. And I was afraid we were going to flip over.
Yeah.
And if you do that, you go into a spin.
Uh-huh.
And if you go into a spin, there's no way you can get out of the airplane. If you flatten out, you can jump out. Mm-hmm. You can get out of the airplane. But, I mean, we just kept on going, going, going. And I said, "Lieutenant, get it down." He says, I'm trying, Monday.
Because you were getting closer and closer to flipping on your back.
Yeah. we got shot three engines out. The left outboard engine, which was one that I was looking at, and it got hit first. And it was the one that flipped us up like this.
Flipped you on your side, yeah.
Yeah. And then the number three engine, this was one, mm-hmm. two, three, and four. Mm-hmm. Number three engine got hit next.
Oh.
And then number four engine got hit. It didn't get a bad hit, but the propeller was going around and around, but it wasn't creating any power. And when it does that, it's actually creating drag. Okay. And the airplane was just dragging along. And there's a procedure called throwing the prop. The propeller, and the pilot tried to throw the prop, and there was something I never understood it. I didn't fly, so I didn't know what he was talking about.
Yeah.
But he was not able to throw that prop off. Mm. If he could have thrown it off, it would have, of course, been gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been some way that he would have juggled the motion of the other engine to make that prop break off from the bindings of it. So we just had that one prop just going around like that,
mm-hmm.
and just barely going, but just making a drag. We were losing altitude. I mean, he just was going down like this,
mm-hmm.
and he was finally able to level it out enough that he just was gliding in slowly, coming in ground level.
Mm-hmm.
And we ground leveled at this airport. We knew where it was,
mm-hmm.
and when we got close enough, and I say when we got close enough, we didn't have enough electricity to use the radio for long distance. And so when we got close enough, the radio operator was able to contact the airfield and said, gave our numbers, and says, we're damaged. We got three engines shot out, and we're coming in for landing. We're in line, and everything's lined up. And the little English girl says, "Well, we're sorry, sir. You can't land now. You'll just have to fly around." And we've got an English Spitfire that's in trouble, and he's landing in front of you. My pilot said to her, and we could hear her. He had the microphone open that we could hear what he was talking about. And he says, "Lady," he says, "I'm not turning this airplane one inch away from the direction that I'm coming right now. I've kept it in this for 650 miles, and that's how far we were into Germany.
Wow.
Says, "I've kept this in this direction for 650 miles on a level plane, and I'm just slowly losing altitude." Says, "I'm not turning these wings one way or the other, or our plane will go down. And says, we're almost too low to jump out. And she says, oh, but you can't land. You can't land. You can't land. And we landed. And the English airplane, he got out of the way. He got down to the end of, towards the end of the runway, mm-hmm. and there was snow on the ground,
oh, gosh.
And he pulled off into the snowbank,
mm-hmm.
And so there wasn't any danger.
So you had wheels. It sounds like you had wheels.
Yeah, we had wheels.
Well, yeah. let me ask you this. In March, when you found out that you were being sent back home or you were being discharged, how did you feel? Like, do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Happy as could be.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was just everybody in the barracks. And there were, I don't have any idea how many people slept in a barracks.
Mm-hmm.
They were long. The beds were double-deckered, and they were close together. I have no earthly idea how many people slept in that barracks. It was that way everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, everybody knew everybody, at least, if not by name, or they knew by name, but they didn't know you. They were saying, well, good luck, and have a good trip home. You're lucky you're getting through. And so I said, well, good luck to you all, and you all hurry up and get it over with.
Mm-hmm.
And see, this was March the 4th, and the war ended in April. So, I mean, I knew that the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when we were flying, there was the Germans did not have enough fighter planes to be able to put up enough of a force to bother the 8th Air Force. I mean, the 8th Air Force, without any trouble, could send in 13,000 airplanes in a one-day mission.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was not unusual for us, 1,000 to 1,300 airplanes to go on a bomb mission, and or 650 or 750.
Mm-hmm.
Or just 1,000,
yeah.
But I mean, we could tell from the German resistance of their air force, and then of course we got the newspaper, the Stars and Stripes,
mm-hmm.
which told us what was going on the ground,
mm-hmm.
and the progress that the ground troops were making, and we knew that the war. Well, our group quit flying before the war ended. Many of the groups quit flying before the war ended. We were just too close to our own troops.
Yeah.
To drop bombs.
So they were really done with you by that point. They were slowing down meeting bombers.
Yeah. We went on meaningful missions. We went to Berlin, and I have a newspaper clipping of it. 1,300 airplanes bombed Berlin. Fifty tons of bombs.
Oh, gosh.
An hour for 3 hours. Were dropped on Berlin, I believe is the way that story goes.
Was that in Stars and Stripes?
Yeah, that was in the Stars and Stripes.
Wow.
And
well, so you were wrapping everything up, and then they fly you back home, and you go back to Knoxville?
Didn't fly back. We were trucked to one English base, and stayed there for a couple weeks, and then we were trucked to the port, and we stayed there about 2 weeks. We were doing KP and cutting grass and doing work. They kept us busy, kept us out of trouble. And finally they said, okay, tonight you're going to leave your barracks and you're going to go to you all talking to us, everybody here in this barracks, we'll go to tent number 12, and they'll come and wake you up and lead you on board ship. Mm-hmm. And we got down there to that, and we had straw mattresses and wool blankets, you know, for the bottom and the top. Not much sleeping done that night. But I did get some sleep. And they got us up real early. I don't know why they got us up so early. We could have gotten in on that ship that night and got into a comfortable bunk. But we got up early, and they marched us on to the ship and marched us and says, okay, Monday, you're there. And Smith, you're there. And Jones, you're there. And I think there were six bunks high, and I was on the third bunk. So
smack dab in the middle.
Yeah. But, you know, there was no problem sleeping. I slept just as good on that, being halfway up. There wasn't any great big rocking and rolling.
Yeah.
Now, maybe we were lucky
yeah.
that we didn't, you know, hit a lot of wind and rain and, mm-hmm. and so forth. But
so they all brought you back to the States and...
It took us, and I can't remember, it took us several weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We were in a convoy,
mm-hmm.
and you can go only as fast in a convoy as the slowest ship can go.
Right.
So I don't remember how long we were on convoy, but it was a smooth convoy.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it. Lord, there was nothing to do.
Right.
But,
hello. Come on in.
You've talked long enough, have you?
No, the lady hasn't said I'm through.
So.
I've got lots to do this afternoon.
You do? Well, you shouldn't have come down here. You should have gone home.
Well, should I ask her? She said just an hour.
I know. It's been about an hour and a half, and I'm sorry.
Well, it's all right. I did a lot of Christmas shopping in the gift shop. Spent all my money.
Well,
and
as long as you spent all of his,
read
too.
My devotional book that I was behind in.
Well, we can be done in less than 5 minutes, I think, because he's...
But I'm froze to death. I'm going out and sit in the car.
Well, if you wanted to, you could sit. There's a bench right there, too, if you want to sit for 5 minutes. I don't want to keep you or...
I want you to do something for me.
Yes, ma'am.
My first love was uh-huh. killed in the Vietnam War.
Okay.
And I would like for you to get for me one of the books that has all of the men in it that were killed and that will say something about them. I found that this happened while I was out at Branson 2 summers ago. And his name was on the board with all the men that were lost.
In Missouri or in general?
No, it just general.
Where is he from?
Where was he from? I think Huntington, West Virginia, or what else is up there that way? It should be a book that has everybody in it, their names in it, I would think.
What was his name?
Frederick L. Frederick L. Love was his last name.
Love, L-O-V-E.
Mm-hmm.
I'll see what I can find and send you and call you and let you know.
Okay, I'll come down and get it.
I'm just curious to know. I'll see where I can find out. Yeah. And then I'll let you know what I find out.
Okay, well, you know, it was high school years and college years.
Sure.
And I just, you know, just curious about it.
Okay, I'll see what I can find out. Okay. All right, I'll be done with him in a second.
Okay.
All right, so you were on your ship, you were on your way home.
If you don't get finished, give him a date and you can come back.
Sure. No, I think we're going to finish.
Okay.
So you, on your way to ship back, and you port in the U.S.
We ported in New York City.
New York City.
And sometime in the morning, I don't know what time it was, somebody came into the area and says, we're about ready to pass the Statue of Liberty.
Uh-huh.
Well, everybody jumped up out of bed and said, come on, let's go up and see the Statue of Liberty. Well, I rolled over and went back to sleep.
Oh.
I did not get up.
Yeah.
And from that time on, there was noise in the ship, and eventually they called for everybody to get out and get packed and get everything packed, and they told us that before, and to get and to go to breakfast.
Yeah.
So we went to breakfast and ate breakfast, and they said then go back to the barracks and wait there, and we'll bring you out by groups.
Yeah.
And we'll walk off of the gangplank and get onto the float and go land into New Jersey. Well, I'll tell you, I didn't get seasick one bit. I got off of that boat. We walked down a ramp, and we were on a float. And I got so seasick from that boat, from that ramp, just, you know, doing this, that, and the other, until finally a Red Cross girl or some female came up and said to me, said, Airman, says, you better sit down. Says, you're sick and you're weaving. Says, you're going to fall down. You're going to be hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat down.
Wow.
And I sat there until they said, okay, let's go.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got back up, man, I was woozy. And I was okay until I got on the ground.
Well, it's a good thing you weren't in the Navy.
Yeah. I asked them on the boat that we were coming back on, that I assumed that all the, what I could thought were sailors. And I said to this one sailor, I said, hey, sailor, says, tell me something. Why is it that the everybody that's on this ship that gets sick is ground troops? And nobody in the Air Force is sick.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I don't know. He says, I've made numerous trips this way, and it's always that way. He says, the ground troopers get sick, and the Air Force people don't. He says, it must be something about your flying in the air.
That's right.
And I said, well, what are you? He says, oh, I'm Coast Guard.
Well, I think this has been a really interesting experience that you've shared. You remember a lot of details, and I think for your wife's sake, we'll probably wrap it up.
Well,
but I, you know, 32 missions in Europe.
35.
35. Sorry, I can't even read my own handwriting. 35 missions in Europe, and going back and forth between England and Germany, and it's lots of experience and all of your training and everything.
Yeah. Well, I actually bombed France.
Oh, did you?
We
also bombed in France.
France and Czechoslovakia and Hungary. Those were
the other
in
ones.
Addition to Germany.
Wow, that's a lot of experience.
Yeah.
Well, so,
of course, you can't tell any difference from 35,000 feet
right.
and the ground.
That's right. And to be such a young man when you did all of this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was
18, 19, 20
years old.
Yeah. Well,
and everybody was.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a crew. Two men on our crew were a little bit older.
Yeah.
Because they had been drafted,
mm-hmm.
and or they had volunteered, I don't remember.
Right.
And had been in at the beginning.
Yeah.
And had been instructors, and were taken off of being an instructor and put on a combat crew.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So everyone really was young.
So everybody else.
Yeah.
Was young.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody in the whole barracks was 18, 19, 20 years
right.
of age.
Well, what a way to start your life. I mean,
yeah,
really.
It. But I wouldn't swap it for anything. I'm glad I'm here to talk about it.
I am too. No, I am too. I'm glad you had adventures without serious injury.
Yeah, it was a good event.
Well, I'm gonna go ahead and stop this, and I'll send you a copy of this.
Okay, so, well, that'll be great. I appreciate that.
Yeah.